Oh, one thing that I wanted to talk about, which I left out of the discussion this morning, but is actually, I think, very important to understand in understanding the theory of Buddhist ethics, and this is another one of the issues with utilitarianism, and I think it's a very important one, and why Buddhism isn't a strict utilitarianism in that sense, is because there's an interdependence, right? And this, I think, is very important. There's an interdependence. We have those two things that we mentioned, the happiness and the intention, right? There's a good intentions lead to happiness, bad intentions lead to suffering. And I mentioned that one of the advantages of the utilitarian approach to ethics was that happiness is at least relatively comprehensible, right? Knowable. We can know whether we're happy or sad, at least to some degree. It's not completely easy, but at least we can get some idea what that is. We can also have at least some idea of what our intentions are. This is the good part, okay? So we can know if I'm angry, you know I'm angry, right? If you're greedy, you know you're greedy. So at least sometimes you know what your intentions are. You don't always, but to some degree you know. So you've got these two knowable things, and there's a relationship between them, right? So of course that helps you to test both of those, right? So you can think, oh, well, I'm acting out of a good intention, but then you realize it leads to a bad result. So then you can then test that. You can then inquire and say, well, was my intention really wholesome? Yeah? Or what was going on there? Yeah? And so similarly, so it's like a self-checking mechanism because we can test both sides of it. Neither side is certain, but because we can test both sides, then that gives that flexibility and that power to it. And that's very characteristic, again, of the early Buddhist teachings, is all these parts are an interconnected part of a greater whole. And this, again, is why one of the reasons why I think that the Buddhist formulation of utilitarian ethics is better than the Western idea, because the idea of what is the greatest happiness for the greatest number doesn't then give you that feedback mechanism, doesn't give you that checking that you have when you also take intention into account. Right? So if you just take the intentions into account, well, you're ignoring the results. Yeah? And if you just take the results into account, then you're ignoring where you're coming from. Right? So in the Buddhist, you recognize that these things are interdependent. So we can independently check both of them and see what the relationship is. So again, I think this is a very important part of the Buddhist ethical practice, why it's so powerful and why it's so solidly grounded in what is knowable, right? It's not impossible to know what is right and what is wrong. Okay, so for this session now, I'd like to cover briefly some of the basic precepts as formulated especially in the Dasa Kusala Kamma Patha, the 10 paths of wholesome action, and in addition to look a little bit more at some of the suttas that we've had for the reading. And we'll see that some of those encapsulate some of those ideas that we've been talking about. Okay, so Dasa Kusala Kamma Patha, and so it's divided into three sections, the section dealing with bodily action, verbal action, mental action, very classical distinction found in Buddhism, and fairly obviously these correlate for the most part with what we know from the five precepts, so the precepts under the paths of wholesome action, not to kill, not to steal, and not kamesu michacharas, not to betray your partner. I won't go into detail into all of these precepts, but just simply to note some of the major aspects of them. Not killing, of course, refers to all sentient beings, not just to humans. Not betraying your partner is an interesting one because that is obviously relative to certain cultural norms in a way that, say, killing isn't, right? So, which comes back to that question of how universal ethical precepts are. And, oh, that's another thing I should have mentioned. It reminds me. You know, we have this big dilemma in modern ethics about are ethics relative or are they universal, right? It's actually a very serious problem. And we don't want to go and say, you know, we have all the answers and we're going to impose our idea of right and wrong on everybody else because this is the absolute right and wrong. But on the other hand, there are some things that people do, and no matter how much their culture might say it's okay, I'm sorry, I am never going to say it's okay, and I don't think that people should be allowed to do that even within their culture. So how do we kind of balance these two things? So I think from the Buddhist point of view, Buddhist ethics is precisely a moral relativism. Okay, I don't think we should be afraid of that phrase, afraid of that saying. And I think it's very clear that the Buddha phrased his ethics in a morally relativist way. Right? That is to say that the ethical precepts are not something which are sort of inscribed in stone in the fabric of the universe somehow, and they're always true for all times, all people, and all places. They're something which is considered in context in terms of their effect, and so on. This is our aspect which is relativist. However, it is also relative to the Buddha's understanding of the human condition, right? It's humans who are making ethical choices, right? And there is, I think, a universal human condition, i.e. we suffer, right? We experience happiness and suffering, and we don't want to suffer, and we want to be happy. So that the grounding of the ethical principles is precisely on that most universal of human experiences. So of course, even animals have suffering and pain, but they don't have ethical choices in the same way that we do, right? So there's that difference. So in a sense, we can say it's relative, but it's relative to something which is universal, at least within the human condition, okay? At least within, maybe there's a world where those things don't apply. Okay, maybe there's some kind of aliens who don't experience pleasure and pain. I can't imagine that would be the case, but maybe it is. And if that was the case, Buddhist ethics wouldn't apply. But within the realm that we know of, where beings do suffer and experience pleasure and pain, then relative to that experience of pleasure and pain, the ethics applies. Yeah? So, of course, given that, then there are certain things which are pretty much constant within each culture, like, say, precepts against not killing. It's not exactly the same in each culture, right? It certainly varies around the edges, but on the whole, that's pretty similar. Other things vary a lot more, and this third precept being one of them, right? The relationship of within a marriage or with a sexual partner and so on, and within human cultures, there are an amazing diversity of different approaches to these kinds of things. I was with the Senate hearing, Senate Select Committee last year, where they're doing hearings into gay marriage, and they took representation from religious communities. So I was there on behalf of the Buddhist community, and there was myself. There was Archbishop, not Pell. Pell wasn't there, but he's the next. Julius Porteous, I think, is there, and the next one, the Catholic guy, and then one of the Anglicans and the Sikhs were there, Hindus, the progressive Jews were there, a couple of other Christian groups, I think maybe the Salvos and one or two others. And we had a meeting in the New South Wales Parliament with a few senators, and so we each had to make our representation. Now, the senators were, there was a number of, kind of, it was an interesting meeting, a number of rules that they laid down. One is that you can't argue with each other, right? You just have to answer our questions, and if you interject, you're out, all right? So that was quite good. And we had previously given them a written submission, so they wanted to ask questions to clarify that written submission. And specifically they asked, what is the textual basis for your position? That was one thing they were specifically interested to know. And so one of the things that came out was that the Christian groups the Christians who were represented at that meeting were from the more conservative side of Christianity, and so they opposed the idea of gay marriage. The Jewish representative was from the progressive Jewry, so he supported it. And at that meeting, it was the Buddhists, the Hindus, and the Jews who supported the gay marriage proposal, and the others opposed it. Although, of course, nobody can represent the whole of their tradition. But one of the things that was interesting there was that the Christians, I can't remember which one it was, I think the Anglicans, they said, you can't have gay marriage. essentially because it was Adam and Eve, it wasn't Adam and Steve. Okay, they didn't actually say that, right? But that was the kind of the gist of what they said, right? And then the Jewish guy says, well, in the Genesis story, they weren't married. Right? Adam and Eve weren't actually married. So you can read the Genesis story as saying, oh, it's fine to go off and live together without getting married. Yeah? So, of course, you have the same scripture and reading completely different conclusions from it.
I have to very quickly tell you that Orthodox Jews generally don't have a problem with gay marital gay sex in general, because it's a man doesn't lie with men. So basically all you have to do is do it standing up.
Okay, yeah, easy, yeah.
They're serious. Once you do it standing up, no problem.
What can I say? Anyway, so we had this thing, and one of the positions which the two Christian teachers who were there were saying was that there is only one and one form of marriage, and it's always been like this. Yeah, and I just found it bizarre, this kind of disconnect from reality. Have they ever read any anthropology? Have they ever talked to anybody outside of, you know, their neighbours or something like that? I mean, have they ever any idea of what actually goes on in human communities? And of course the reality is that these norms of marriage are usually norms that rich white patriarchs expect other people to keep, right? That's basically where these rules come from. And one of the interesting things, and I did a bit of research in this, to look at, well, what is the Indian heritage of this. Now, of course, within the Buddhist context, we don't have a Buddhist marriage ceremony as such, but we tend to use the different marriage ceremonies in the different cultures that we're in. And I did some research in the Indian sphere, and of course, with the Hindu marriages, like so many other things in Hinduism, well, it's very encompassing, right? It's very diverse. There's not the idea of this one and only one form of marriage just doesn't exist. And in fact, there's a whole range of different forms of marriage which are accepted within the Hindu law books, not to speak of the actual practice in people. So they will have a different form of marriage for each level of the celestial hierarchy. So the best form is the Brahma wedding, where both my husband and wife are pure on both sides for seven generations and so on and so forth. So it fills all of these requirements. And then gradually it goes down and down and down until you get to the Gandharva wedding, which is the kind of the lowest form of still good kind of wedding, which is essentially where you elope, right? So you just run off together and start living together, and that's a perfectly valid marriage, okay? You don't have any ceremony, you don't have any priest, you don't have the permission of the parents, you don't have anything else. You just start living together, but it's not considered the best kind of marriage, but it's still considered a perfectly valid legal marriage within that system. And then, of course, you have unwholesome forms of marriage as well, which would be like abduction and rape and these kinds of things. So this and the system sort of encompasses this kind of broad spectrum of things. So there's no one kind of marriage. This is why both the Buddhist and the Hindu representatives didn't have any objection to the gay marriage proposal. And one of the interesting things that came up in that context around that time was that there was a letter or a speech by the Indian Attorney General on this very topic. And he said something which, you know, some of us have been saying for years, and it was fascinating to hear the Attorney General of India saying it. And he was saying that many modern Indians and modern Hindus believe that gay marriage and homosexuality is against Hinduism, whereas in fact all of these kinds of attitudes were imported by the British, and they're actually British and Christian prejudices which were brought into Indian culture and adopted, and now we've forgotten our own heritage. But in the colonial days, all of the gay Englishmen used to love to go to India because it was so permissive, right? So it became the kind of the resort for the gay English gentlemen to go and have a good time, and that was the reason why they then later on brought in these rules. Right, that's where those rules come from. Yeah.
And just in one of the readings this week by the first one, so it's either the first or second one, it struck me that when the Buddhist was talking about misdemeanors with the monks, so he only mentioned women, going with women, going with girls. There's no mention of going men, and when I read it, I thought, that's interesting, is that because he hasn't even imagined it happening, or Certainly
not because they didn't imagine it happening. If you look in the Vinaya, then there's both male and female and female relations talked about quite extensively, and it's never made a big deal of. Okay, it's basically treated exactly the same way as any other kind of relationship. Yeah. And there's never a kind of fuss made about it as such, right? I mean, obviously, in the context of monastic discipline, the monks and nuns shouldn't be having sexual relations of any kind. But there's no differentiation between those things, yeah. So the fact that it doesn't occur in those kinds of descriptions is more, I think, just a function of the sort of conventional nature of the text rather than anything else. You know, it's also, for example, you see those things are often phrased solely from a male point of view. Right, so it's saying, you know, you shouldn't sleep with somebody else's wife, right? So it's not I don't think it's meant to imply that it's fine for women to sleep with somebody else's husband. I don't think that's the lesson that we're meant to draw from that. Although if we were to interpret it as literally as the lying down rule, then we could say, yeah, that's fine, women, you're okay. But I think there is some, you know, it's a conventional way of phrasing it. So yeah, I think we're meant to draw the appropriate inferences from it now. Okay, so again, to just come back to this idea, once we've acknowledged that within the Buddhist tradition and the Indian tradition more broadly, that there isn't one and only one specific form of marriage, then adultery then takes on a more broad meaning as well, doesn't it, right? So it doesn't just mean betraying someone who you're married to, right? So if you have a girlfriend, then it's all right to betray them, right? Because I'm not married and that's not adultery. But obviously it means betraying anybody that you're in a relationship with, anybody that you're in love with, and so on. Suttas, within the suttas and the Vinaya, there's many other kinds of ethical transgressions which are mentioned, which are not covered under the usual precepts. And there's a lot of suttas that mention these in some detail. You have things like the Parabahava Sutta, the Vasala Sutta, and many others which talk about different kinds of ethical problems. Some of them include drinking. You find in the five precepts it mentions to refrain from alcohol, whereas that's not mentioned in the Dasa Kusala Kamapata. And so if you want to argue from an early Buddhist textual perspective that there's a bit of wiggle room regarding taking a bit of alcohol in the evening, then you could probably, I think it would be worth doing a PhD on that one, and you can make a case to justify that one. Pedophilia is also mentioned. In the sense of taking a very young wife, we have this idea often from modern Hindu culture that brides were married very young, we see in Indian culture in recent centuries, but we don't find any evidence for that particularly in the time of the Buddha. A young bride is said conventionally to be 16 years of age. And it's very difficult to find any evidence of marriage at a younger age than that. There is one or two places where it's mentioned as a vice for somebody to take a very young girl as their partner. Addiction to gambling and so on and so forth mentioned also as ethical precepts under this thing from
Tajra. Sexual trafficking, we're coming to that now?
Of course, yeah. Sexual trafficking and, yeah. I mean, in any kind of trafficking, yeah, it comes under wrong livelihood, yeah. Okay, actions of body, actions of speech. So speech, four kinds of wrong speech that is not lying, backbiting, harsh, or stupid speech. One thing, of course, to remember with all of these precepts is that when they're phrased as precepts, they're usually phrased in a negative sense, and they're refraining from such and such. But when the Buddha was talking about them, we saw in the gradual training in the Chulahati Padokama Sutta as part of the reading that these are often phrased, in fact normally they're phrased in a positive sense, and all of the precepts have a positive meaning. It doesn't just mean not to kill, but it means having compassion for all sentient beings, right? And so similar with these things, the speech, it doesn't just mean not lying, but it means using speech in a skillful way. Speaking the truth at the right time, for the right reasons, speaking in a way that is gentle and pleasing, and reconciling people and so on and so forth. So this also is very important, that I think that in some respects, how ethics are presented in the traditions, I think we've seen a dumbing down of ethics. So usually it's just like you get the five precepts and then you recite the five precepts, and even often you don't even know what they mean. And if you're lucky enough to actually have someone explain to you what they mean, I mean, this is very true. I'm sure many of you from Buddhist cultures probably know this, but those of you who are not from Buddhist cultures, I mean, I've sat down with groups of people in Thailand, and you know, you ask them what's the five precepts, and they go, they've chanted these things like every week for years, right? And you say, well, what's the first precept? So it becomes a fairly meaningless exercise. But even if you know what it means, then it's still very simple. It's just not doing this, right? And so you end up with a culture where not doing things is regarded as the highest virtue, right? And this is something which I think infects Buddhism, both monastic Buddhism and the lay cultures, far too much. There seems to be something intrinsically virtuous in not saying anything. Right? The Buddha never said it's good to not say anything. Buddha was talking all the time. Where do you think we got all these suttas from? Right? The point is that you should speak at the right time, in the right way. Yeah? And this is a very, very important part of practice. There's nothing inherently virtuous about not speaking.
I find this one a really tricky one if you're talking about happiness as the signifier of doing the right thing, because we live in a culture where venting often makes... I was challenged this way earlier this week with the funeral of Margaret Thatcher. And, it's not saying things, it's not venting, it doesn't always lead to happiness.
Mm. But I guess venting and speaking out is a little bit different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Expressing in quiet to your partner without doing any harm to anybody maybe is okay, isn't it?
Well, no, venting, a great example of venting and a classic example was Julia Gillard's taking down of Tony Abbott about sexism, yeah? And that was very, very impressive because she kept it under control. She was obviously absolutely furious, but made perfect sense, yeah? And there was facts and there was details and it was completely coherent. That is kind of hard to do. Yeah? Yeah.
A little bit lost with this speech. Why does it actually encompass the according to the sutra?
Ah, well, just look at any YouTube comment section and you'll find plenty of examples. I actually had you could get for what, because I do my blog on WordPress, and someone developed a plugin, a dumb filter for WordPress, so you can automatically filter out dumb comments. And so things that have lol, OMG, and so on, they're going to get automatically filtered out, right? And, so if you think about the skillful use of speech, is a use of speech which increases wisdom, right? Which moves yourself and moves others from ignorance towards wisdom. So stupid speech is something, anything that moves towards ignorance.
What's backbiting?
Backbiting? Well, I go around and tell somebody, "Oh, Wendy's such a bitch. Don't trust her." And then I go there and then I tell you that, "Oh, he's such a bitch, don't talk to him.
But that would be speech that's designed to split as opposed
exactly.
to speech that's designed to...
To create harmony. It's
not just technically gossip, because someone's gossip can be...
That's right.
...designed to actually heal it.
That's right, yeah. Gossip itself, I think, that's why I didn't put gossip in there. Some people say gossip. But gossip actually can form a positive function, definitely, yeah. Well, definitely, yeah. I mean, well, it depends how you define gossip or whatever. But if you define gossip as, let's say two people talking about a third person, right? then that can just, that's not that anything intrinsically unwholesome about that, because you know you can be sharing experiences and coming to a greater understanding of what that person is. Huh? So you know, there's a spectrum there, so where you have to look at the content of it, what's actually happening. Yeah.
It's quite a transactional view of speech, isn't it? That uh-huh. I speak in order to tell you something uh-huh. seems to lie behind this. Whereas it seems to me a lot of speech is in fact about creating relationship,
right.
Maintaining group identity, expressing emotion and feeling and so on. And it's not that that's prohibited by that, but it seems to pass it by.
No, it doesn't. I mean, it hasn't spelled it out explicitly there, but in the when it's talking about the let me pull that up. Yeah, so this is the actual full definition of the four kinds of right speech which we're discussing at the moment. So the four kinds of verbal conduct, which are, I'll go to the positive side. Okay, four kinds of verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, abandoning false speech when abstains from false speech, when summoned to a court or a meeting or his relative's presence or to his guild or the royal family's presence, is questioned as a witness thus. So, good man, tell me what you know. And not knowing, he says, I do not know. Or knowing, he says, I know. Not seeing, he says, I do not see. Or not seeing, he says, I do not see. So he does not in full awareness speak falsehood for his own ends or for another's ends or for some trifling worldly end. So here's the definition of lying, which is given specifically in a legal context, which is quite interesting. Obviously, it doesn't not meant to imply just that, but this is a sort of one of the most serious forms of false speech. So the next one, malicious speech, abandoning, he becomes one who it doesn't repeat elsewhere what is heard here for the purpose of causing division from these. Okay? So it doesn't mean that you can't repeat it or you can't, you know, talk about somebody, but what's your purpose? Nor does he repeat to these what's heard elsewhere for the purpose of causing division from those. He's a reuniter of the divided, promoter of friendships, enjoying concord, rejoicing in concord, delighting in concord, becomes a speaker of words that promote concord. Yeah? And so this is specifically that aspect. And notice that if you are actually doing that, right? You're not just not speaking, but you are actually saying those things. Yeah.
I read this, and it's still up there, the abandoning gossip becomes one which explains the gossip. The sense I got was gossip is another word would be prattle, sort of idle chatter,
yeah. Is
what I would call it.
Yeah.
My sense is not keen on that.
That's right. I think it's if you look at it, what it's,
but
that's
it's
why
not material positive. It's just this. Yeah. We can entertain ourselves.
That's right. That's why I wouldn't use the word gossip in there. I mean, there's been actually some interesting psychological or anthropological studies on gossip in recent years that have actually shown it has a lot of useful social functions. But so this, if you look at how it's defined, what it's talked about, what is at the right time, what is on truth. What is good, what is dhamma, what is vinaya, what is worth recording or worth remembering, reasoned, definite, and connected with good. Yeah? So it's speech which is in it, you know, which has those qualities of being meaningful, clear, useful, and so on. That's what's being meant here, and then the opposite. So yeah, I don't think that's why I just said stupid speech rather than gossip. So here's an example of speech, whether right or wrong. Calvin puts up his hand, the teacher says, yes, Calvin, and Calvin says, Miss Wormwood, I'm a fierce advocate of the separation of church and state. Nevertheless, I feel the need for spiritual guidance and comfort as I face the day's struggles. So I was wondering if I could strip down, smear myself with paste, and set fire to this little effigy of you in a non-denominational sort of way. And then he's sitting outside the principal's office saying, boy, what a touchy subject. I just put that in there. I thought it was funny. All right, mental behaviour, we should stop and do some meditation, shouldn't we? Yeah, let's stop and do some meditation. Okay, so moving along. Next aspect of the 10 ways of wholesome action, Dasa Kusala Kamapata, is the kind of mental behavior. And here what it's talking about is basically strong forms of greed, hatred, and delusion. So covetousness, hatred, and wrong views are strong forms of greed, hatred and delusion. So these become bases of karma, not when you just have a sort of random thought of greed or hatred or delusion or whatever, but when these become sort of strong and fixed tendencies in your mind. With covetousness I won't go into those things in too much detail, but one thing I will mention is what it means by wrong view. I've translated here pernicious view. And it's important that what this doesn't mean is a view which is factually incorrect. Okay, that's a completely different matter. What this means is views that lead to harm. Right? And this is something where we can see in our world how powerful this is. Right? So if you have a lot of these twisted and distorted ideologies, right, how much harm do they lead to people? It's astonishing that people will go and kill themselves and blow things up and go to war and do all of these kinds of things because they have some idea about, you know, some ancient text or about some religious idea or some political philosophy or something like that. And they have this, it's become such a part of their reality that they can't conceive that the world actually could be any other way. The world has to be the way that it is in my idea of the world, even if I have to beat it into submission to make it so. And so this kind of fixed, pernicious view is what it's talking about here. This is the kind of thing which really leads to a lot of harm. So this is a very important part of our spiritual practice, is to learn to test our views, to question things, to change. If you look back in your life and you think, I haven't changed my opinions about anything for the last 10 years, then you've got a problem, right? Huh? Your opinions are not all that good, right? And you know, you have to look back and you think, oh yeah, I'm kind of very proud of things. You know, you look back and think, well, I've changed my view about that, changed my idea. And then you realize, well, actually there is an ongoing process, there's an evolution, there's a movement towards greater openness or greater flexibility or whatever it is. So this is something you should always be testing. Okay, so that's just a summary of the 10 Kusala Kammapattas. I want to move on to the last aspect of ethics we want to cover. Remember that the three things I mentioned at the beginning was the ethical theory, the pragmatics of the precepts, which we just covered, and then last is the purpose of ethics, how it fits in with the path as a whole. And we'll look a bit more at some of the texts that we've assigned for the reading in this context. So just some basic ideas here. The purpose of ethics: to live happily, to live without harming. Okay, so that's a kind of good motivation. Ethics leads to a good rebirth is something else which is mentioned and which comes up in some of the suttas that we're looking at. Now, obviously there's a difference here between the more empirical or more obvious idea that, well, if you keep precepts you can be happy, to something, well, we don't know whether we're going to get reborn or what's going to happen after we die, so that's a bit harder to assess. And that difference is also found quite explicitly in the suttas themselves, okay? And I'll just give one example of that. Was a conversation between Siha, the general, had a conversation with the Buddha, and Siha said to the Buddha, I like to practice generosity. What fruits do I get from generosity? What are the benefits of practicing generosity? And the Buddha listed five things, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but they were something like, you feel happy, you feel confident when you're in an assembly, you'll have a good reputation, and I think there was something else. And then the last one, he said, you get to go to heaven. And Siha gave the reply. He said, well, I myself practice generosity and I've become happy because of that, so I can see that this is correct. I practice generosity and I have a good reputation, so I see that's correct. I practice generosity and then I'm confident when I'm in an assembly. And he also said the fourth one, which I can't remember. And he said, but that fifth one, that when you practice generosity, you go to heaven, I can't see that for myself, so I guess I just have to take that on trust. And the Buddha said, yes, that's right, you can't see that for yourself, so you know you have to take that on trust. So that difference is acknowledged there quite explicitly. And as we know from many other suttas, And the Chulahati Padokama Sutta was also part of the reading, makes this very point very strongly that, you know, when you say you accept something on trust, it means you do not insist, I know this, this must be true and nothing else must be the case, right? It just means, well, okay, that's what I believe, right? That's all. And in time, maybe it'll be turn out to be right or turn out to be wrong. But you know that's just something that you accept. If you have faith, the Buddha was teaching was right, say, okay, well, I'll take that on board and we'll see how that pans out. So that from the Buddha's point of view, it is possible to empirically know whether rebirth is true by developing various psychic powers and various other ways. So it is possible, but of course it's quite difficult, right? But the fact that something's difficult doesn't mean that it's not an empirical teaching, right? It's possible for us to test how fast is the speed of light, right? I don't know how to do it. It's difficult. Okay, you stand on that side of the room, I'll stand on this side of the room, I'll flip the torch on, and we'll have a stopwatch, okay? So it's possible to do, right? But you can't do it without a lot of time and money and expertise and so on. So the fact that something's difficult doesn't mean it can't be tested, but it just means that we have to, if we can't test it ourselves, I have to say, well, I trust the physicists, they worked it out, right? They seem to know what they're doing. They've got doctorates and stuff. So, anyway. And the last thing, a purpose of ethics, and this is the more specifically spiritual thing and the thing which is very central in Buddhism, is the foundation for meditation, right? The foundation for samadhi, which is what we're going to discuss more in the next workshop. Yes, Inkong.
Before leading to a good rebirth, I'm surprised that why not leading to a good future, because instead of talking about next birth, we all know that when we are practicing good ethics, the goodness from the good ethics comes tomorrow, next month, or next year.
Yeah.
So there is the karma within one lifetime that we can experience.
Sure.
So heaven is here, hell is here, depending on our ethics.
Sure, and that comes within the first one of those thingies.
Well, that is about happy. I think there's a difference between happy and being and feeling goodness.
And good
behavior, we reap the harvest of good behavior that is good for us and everyone.
Okay, fair enough. But that was just meant to encompass those benefits that we can see in this life. Uh-huh. The point is simply that. The Buddha did talk about that, that it leads to benefits in the future life as well. And that has meaning at least for some people. It might not have meaning for everyone. And one thing that is very important, and you find in the Kalama Sutta and other places, the Buddha never hung his idea of ethics off a belief of rebirth, right? So he never said, if you believe in rebirth, then you have a good justification for doing good, right? He said, well, there are these many reasons for doing good, one of which is that it gets you a good rebirth, right? But it never made ethical choices dependent on that belief in rebirth.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the most important point. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so sila is also the foundation for samadhi. Ethics is the foundation for meditation and peace of mind. Now, this is not a arbitrary relationship, and it's not an incomprehensible, it's not a kind of mystical thing, but there are specific things that we're doing when we're practicing ethics and keeping our precept which leads to those states of peace of mind and meditation. But specifically, we can say that when we refrain from killing, then we're helping to overcome the hatred. When we refrain from non-stealing, not committing adultery, we're restraining our greed. When we're refraining from drinking or from lying, then we're restraining the delusion. Okay, so these are quite obvious relationships, a very direct connection between those same forces which underlie the tendency to commit these ethical transgressions are the same things which are disturbing us and causing problems in our meditation. So in the commentarial tradition, and this is not explicitly said in the suttas, but it's very much in line with what the suttas say, they distinguish the defilements or the forces of the mind that lead to suffering, the afflictions of the mind, into three levels. The most basic level of which is those expressed through acts of body and speech, so those which cause a transgression of our precepts. So that's the first level of greed, hatred, and delusion. Then the next level of greed, hatred, and delusion are those which disturb the mind and stop us from finding peace in meditation. So we overcome those through practicing samadhi. And then the final level is those which lead to suffering and rebirth and the samsara and so on. And those are the ones which are overcome through wisdom and through insight. So those three levels, it's the same thing. It's greed, hatred, and delusion, operating in coarse forms, moderate forms, and subtle forms. And so each stage of the practice is overcoming these things. So this is, I think this is very important to understand, and this integrated nature of the teachings. This is something which I think is misrepresented in a lot of, I've seen a lot of this in academic presentations of Buddhism, where they kind of divide lay Buddhism from monastic Buddhism. And say, well, you know, for lay people it's taught, you know, be generous and go to heaven, and then for monastics it's like, you know, abandon all defilements and get enlightened. But the point is that these things, yes, in terms of emphasis, that there is a difference in emphasis and how these things are presented, but underlying it is this idea that all of these practices are helping us to overcome greed, hatred, and delusion in one way or another. So it's all part of that same path. Not in just an abstract or woolly-minded way, but in a specific way, that we're doing these specific things to overcome these specific forces which are leading to suffering. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just wondering, the quality of mindfulness, is that sort of like the medium through which this happens? Like, how does that fit into
mindfulness?
Yeah.
Yes, mindfulness supports everything on the path, right? But it doesn't have to be that much mindfulness. Right? I mean, you have to have some mindfulness, but mindfulness itself is most specifically pertains to the next stage of the path, which is meditation. Right? Now, you can, say, refrain from killing, right, or refrain from stealing. You don't have to have all that much mindfulness to do that. Okay, you have to have some, right, but you don't have to have very highly developed mindfulness. Except maybe in some circumstances you might need to, but most of the time you don't. Yeah. So mindfulness as such is a more subtle quality. Let me put it another way. You can teach precepts and get people to teach precepts without even talking about mindfulness. Yeah? And people can still understand those precepts and can still keep them. Yeah? So mindfulness is still there, but it really comes into its own in the next section, in the text section on meditation.
But would you say that mindfulness itself embodies ethics?
What do you mean by embodies ethics?
When we practice mindfulness at a level, we are already in ethical behavior thinking?
Sure, but in a sense of already assuming the ethics. So the ethics, in a sense, is prior. Yeah, so that's again is my point. I'm not saying that mindfulness isn't involved. I'm just saying that the mindfulness specifically, if we're practicing that, is a more subtle thing, which is already relying on the ethics as its foundation.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all. The reason for saying that is because it's to ensure that we don't make things too complicated. If people think, oh, well, I have to be doing meditation and have this really high level of mindfulness before I even start keeping precepts, right? You say, well, this is something that you can do. Don't steal from anyone. Can you do that? And then you start from the simple things and build them up. Alright? So the next one, this is really just a springboard for the looking at some of the sutta material, but the most detailed presentation of monastic ethics that we find in the suttas comes in the gradual training. So this is what we find in the Chulahatta Vinokama Sutta and many, many other places in the canon. And that's the gradual training presents sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, meditation, and wisdom in its most detailed form. Of course, you find much more detailed presentation of monastic ethics in the Vinaya, but as far as the suttas are concerned, this is the most detailed one. And really, the presentation we find in the suttas is, in many ways, is quite sufficient. Right? The Vinaya just exists as a legal document to kind of make sure that people keep the rules, right? But for a long time, the Buddha didn't want to give the Vinaya. He wanted to present ethics in a way that people would be aspire to, right? So this is the best way of conduct. This is how I do things, and you also should aspire to do things in this way. And as long as the monks and nuns were well behaved and sincere, they didn't need anything else, right? So this was probably the code and description of conduct which existed prior to the formulation of a sort of legalistic code of discipline. Includes the basic precepts that we've already covered, as well as many other details, and also covers the right livelihood, which is something we haven't looked at today in terms of ethics, but also, of course, is a very important aspect. And we find, since the Buddha was a monastic and he was teaching a monastic community, then the most detail we find is in talking about monastic ethics, but there were also many, many teachings we find in early Buddhism given to lay people for discussing lay ethics and so on. The most detailed one is called the Sigalavada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. That's a very famous one in the Theravadan countries, and a very beautiful description of ethics for lay people. We might have a look at that later. But many, many other suttas, especially in the Guttara Nikaya, are either given directly for lay people or else relevant for them. Okay, so here I will leave the slideshow and we will just have a look at some of these suttas and see how some of the things that we've talked about are present within these suttas themselves. Now the first one that I'll have a look at, we have the Salayaka Sutta. I'll just look at this briefly because we've already discussed this in some detail with the 10 paths of wholesome action, but just to continue on it, the Brahman... So forgive me for turning around now, but I can't see this on my screen now. I can only see this on the screen up there. So the Buddha, wandering in the Kosalan country, came to the Kosalan Brahman village called Sala. The Brahman householders heard about it. They went to see the Buddha. And when they were seated, they said to him, "What's the reason, what's the condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in states of deprivation, even in hell? What's the reason why others appear even in heaven?" Now notice that the Buddha's responding to this question. When the Buddha teaches about ethics of his own volition, right, he usually doesn't bring up heaven and hell as the main thing, like in this sutta, right? He might include it within a list of benefits, but here he's responding to the question. So it was something which was current at the time. And remember that when the Buddha is giving his answer, he's giving his answer to Brahmins, okay? And from the traditional Brahmanical response to this would be, you go to heaven because you practice the rituals as laid out in the Rig Veda. Okay, that's why you go to heaven. And in the later Hindu legends that they developed when they adopted the Buddha as being an avatar of Vishnu, okay, so according to later Hinduism, the Buddha was really a Hindu all along. And the reason why he was born was because before the Buddha's time, everybody was practicing the rituals, the Vedic rituals, and everybody was going to heaven. And so because of that, the devas were full to overflowing, and all the hell realms were empty, right? So you had this whole demographic problem. And then in the war between the devas and the asuras, the devas kept on winning. And the universe was just going out of balance. So Vishnu, his role is to balance the universe. Okay? It's Vishnu's special role. And so Vishnu thought, I can't have this. So I'll incarnate as the Buddha, and then I'll convince people to stop performing the rituals. And because of that, they'll all go to hell. And because they go to hell, they will rebalance the universe. Okay?
So they're bodhisattvas, really.
Well, exactly, yeah. So we have a purpose in life. So this is about 4th or 5th century that we find this myth appearing. Anyway, so the Buddha was quite... The Buddha wasn't the first one to correlate our destiny with our ethical conduct, but he was certainly one of the first, and he was certainly one of the ones to state it most clearly and put it at a very central place. So the Buddha gives a brief answer. Well, good conduct leads to heaven and bad conduct leads to hell. So again, they say they don't understand that, and we can appreciate why they say that, because this is completely against their expectations, right? Their expectation is doing the rituals leads you to heaven. So the Buddha then goes on in detail, 3 kinds of bodily conduct, 4 kinds of verbal conduct, 3 kinds of mental conduct, as we've just discussed with the Dasa Kusala Kamapata. the one who kills living beings is murderous, bloody handed, given to blows and violence, takes what is not given, takes another's chattels and property in the village or in the forest. He's given over to misconduct and sexual desires. He has intercourse with such women as are protected by the mother, father, brother, sisters, relatives, as have a husband or as entail a penalty, or those who are garlanded in token of betrothal, and which essentially means somebody who's engaged, right? As entail a penalty. I'm not exactly sure what that would mean, but it would. I think these days that would be something like, say, underage. Someone who's underage, yeah, so protected by the law. So essentially what this means is transgression of that kind of protection. But again, this is obviously quite culturally dependent. Interesting to note here that the woman who has intercourse in could be protected by either the mother or the father, brother or the sisters, so that she could be protected by either her male or female relatives, which is quite different from the situation in the later Manusmriti and other Dharma Shastras, where she is always expected to be under the protection of a male. Obviously, this doesn't cover the case of an independent woman, but only of a woman who usually is underage or for some reason is under some protection or guardianship. Okay, verbal conduct we've already had a look at, mental conduct. So the mind of ill will, may these beings be slain and slaughtered, may they be cut off, perished, or be annihilated. Okay, so this is the kind of ill will. So it's not just talking about a thought of hatred or something like that. Right? This is talking about having a very unwholesome state of mind. Notice with the positive statements, abandoning the killing of living beings, one becomes one with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Yeah? So this is that positive side of keeping the ethics. Okay, so he goes through all the 10 pathways and then says, this is how to get to heaven. And then if a householder observes this conduct, then he wishes that after they die that they might reappear as a warrior noble of great property, then they can do that, or they might wish they'll be reborn as a Brahmin of great property. I'm not sure if there's an intended irony on that. He's talking to Brahmins and he's saying, well, you might want to be reborn as a Kshatriya. I think, I'm not quite sure whether any of the Brahmins would actually wish that, but anyway, you can be reborn as a householder and in these different heavenly realms and so on. One of the interesting things about this particular sutta, which is a bit weird in terms of the generally accepted Buddhist teaching, is that it includes all these kind of lists of gods. Many of them are Brahma realms, and the attainment of the Brahma realm is usually said to be dependent on developing jhanas, but there's no mention of developing jhanas here. Personally, I think that's most likely just this list has probably just been elaborated at some later date. And then even leading up to arahantship. Okay, so afterwards the Brahmin householders went for refuge. Okay, so I'll just briefly have a look at, there's a comparative study done by Venerable Analia, which hopefully you had time to have a look at as part of the reading. And I'll just briefly, I won't go through all the details in the comparative study, but just to note that the Salayika Sutta has one parallel, which is in the Samyutta Agama. Okay, so in the Samyutta Agama number 142, also very similar Sutta Samyutta Agama 143. And notice that the Salayika as Majjhima Nikaya number 41, there's also a very, very similar Sutta. The very next Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya number 42 is almost identical. And there's a similar Sutta also elsewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya. So these are the recognized parallels for this particular Sutta. Now, so these, if you want to find out what the parallels are, so here we are on Sutta Central, it's the best website in the world, so you can always come here and find what the parallels are, as well as translations and so on and so forth. When I say the best website in the world, I don't mean just the best website, it's the best thing in the world. Okay?
And not quite serious. This world.
Sorry?
And not just in this world.
Well, not the best thing in any world. Oh, of course, yeah. Because the Buddha's Dhamma is the best thing that there is in the world. And this is the best presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma that there is. So this is the best thing in the world.
Is this now live?
The website? It is actually live, although it's not public in a sense. It is still /news. So it is actually on the internet. You go to sutta-central/new. But we haven't publicly launched it. There's a couple of niggling problems with the navigation, which we haven't, not the navigation, but the display of the parallels, where somehow we haven't quite worked out how to pull up the right parallels in all cases for the suttas. But we're hoping to sort that out in the next few days. But that's the only major problem we have at the moment. Yeah. Okay, so back to the comparative study, and I won't go through all the details of the comparative study. As always, there's many interesting things in there. But the main thing to acknowledge here, remember that I said when looking at it, is that the that list of the getting reborn in the Brahma realms and so on looks a little bit suspicious because it contradicts the normal understanding of how you get reborn in those places. And indeed, we find that in the parallel to that, in the Chinese, that it doesn't have that detailed list, that it has a more abbreviated list of the rebirths in the Brahma realm. It still has that idea, but a much more abbreviated. So it does suggest that that's been elaborated to some degree. And whereas the Pali just has that you go to these heavenly realms, and then it says you go to the ending of defilements. Whereas in the Chinese version, it mentions more detail about attaining jhanas and Brahma viharas and so on and so forth. So that there's more of a kind of a gradual context for this, as for the 10 kusala kamapata as a foundation for the higher spiritual attainments. There's also some other minor differences. In the Pali version, the Brahmins at the end are delighted and take refuge, whereas in the Chinese version, they're delighted and then leave without taking refuge. Okay, so these are the kinds of differences which we find constantly throughout the different versions of suttas in the Pali and the Chinese. But as always, the actual core of the teaching, the 10 paths of wholesome action, are identical in both versions. Okay, only those incidental background details are different. And Analia gives the full translation here for anybody who's interested to look at the detail of the translation. So moving on to... we've already had a look at the Kusala Sutta. Now we have the Ambalaptika Rahulovada Sutta. So this is in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this one has quite a number of parallels. And we can see that Chinese parallel at the Majjhima Agama number 14 and several other places in the Chinese canon. These ones are in vinayas. These ones look like they're independent suttas just floating in the Chinese canon. Also Sanskrit fragments from Turfan and also Tibetan in the Dulba, which is the Tibetan vinaya. So probably the reason why it would be in the vinaya is because the Tibetan vinaya has an extensive biography of the Buddha. So this one has an interaction between the Buddha and his son Rahula as a sort of human interest story. So that would be why it would be included there. And also, of course, has an ethical kind of vinaya aspect to it. So here's the translation of the Pali text by Venerable Nyanaponika, I believe. Again, we won't look at it in detail, but I want to look at this to reinforce a couple of points. One point is the teaching method that the Buddha uses. Yeah, so here he holds up the glass of water. I won't do the same thing because this is actually half full, but he's actually using a kind of demonstration, especially when he's talking to his son. He's quite a young boy, so he can't give him too much of an abstract teaching. So he's using these kind of examples, and this is just one of the examples you see of the Buddha's skill in teaching. We see the small quantity of water in the vessel. Similarly, insignificant indeed is the summonership. What a terrible word. Who invented that word, summonership? That's not a word. That's Buddhist hybrid English. It basically means your integrity as a spiritual practitioner. That's essentially what it means, yeah. You have no integrity as a spiritual practitioner if you are ashamed of uttering deliberate lies. Then he threw away that small quantity of water and said, do you see that small quantity of water thrown away? Similarly, is discarded is the integrity of spiritual practice of those who fare, who live without being ashamed of deliberate lying. Then he turned the water vessel upside down and said, do you see this upside down? And he said, similarly, Rahula, overturned is the spiritual integrity of those who are not ashamed of uttering deliberate lies. And finally he turned it up again and said, see, this is empty and void. He said, similarly, empty and void is the spiritual integrity of those who are not ashamed of deliberate lies. Okay, so then he gives the simile of the elephant. Also, I think a very skillful simile to give to a boy. You know, this is kind of a, you know, I'm sure the kids are kind of fascinated by war elephants and things like that, so this would be a good one to use as a simile. I won't go into that in detail, but then he says, not even in play will I utter a lie, or not even as a joke will I utter a lie. So this is something which is obviously asked of Ajahn Brahm from time to time. And so one time there was this Irishman, the Englishman, and the Buddhist monk walked into a bar, and no. Is that a lie? Well, what are you doing when you're lying? Well, of course, the point of a lie is that you're deliberately creating a false belief, right? So this doesn't mean telling a story or something like that where everybody knows that it's just a joke, right? What this means is that you lie to somebody and say, you know, you left the pot boiling on the stove and your house is burning down, right? And so they run home thinking their house is burnt down. And then and afterwards you say, no, it was only a joke. And they say, that was terribly funny. Okay, so what it means is part of the joke is you have to deliberately create that false belief. So as long as you're just, everybody knows it's a joke, then that's not counted here. Okay, and then it brings up this idea of reflection. And so this is that process which I was talking about, the relationship between the intention and then the result of it. And that reflective process, reflecting like a mirror. Mirrors, it's going round and round. You say, when I do that action with the body, will this lead to harm of myself, of others, or both myself and others? Right? So this is then unskillful. It's akusala. If you realize this bodily action while you're doing it, or even after you're doing it. Yeah? And similarly with a vocal action and a mental action. So it goes into quite some detail. But then it says, if you realize that this action that I've done is wrong, then you should confess it, reveal it, and tell it to your teacher or to some learned or to your brothers in the holy life. And then you should restrain yourself in the future. Again, notice this Buddhist way of dealing with transgressions. And this is something that we do formally as part of the Vinaya. We meet every 2 weeks. And we confess if we have our offences. Again, this is something where, unfortunately, in the traditions, this has become watered down. What you do these days is you meet and you say, I've committed all offences. Right? You have this formula. You say in Pali, all offences past, present and future. I have committed, or I will commit, or I might commit, or whatever, and please forgive me for all of those. And then someone says a formula and say, I forgive you for all offences past, present and future. That's not what you're supposed to do. The Vinaya is very clear. The Vinaya says, if you remember an offence, you should confess it. Yeah? If you remember it. So it's talking about this process of reflection. What is it that I've done? If you remember, if you didn't remember it, then there's no requirement to confess it. Yeah? Saramanena bhikkhu bhikkhuna. So if by a bhikkhu who remembers, they should confess it. So and once you've confessed it, it doesn't say, notice it doesn't say you should then feel guilty about it. You should then beat yourself up about it. You should then keep on reminding yourself again and again and again what a terrible person you are for having done this terrible thing. Right? And that's not what it says. It says you mention it to someone, say, I did this, and they say, okay, do better in the future. You say, okay, I'll do better in the future. That's it. Okay? So you acknowledge it, you recognize it, you do better again in the future. Yeah? And then, for that very reason, when you do that, you know this is not conducive to harm or to harm myself or others. For that very reason, you should abide in joy and happiness, training yourself day and night in good states.
Just got another question. That's the earlier part of the Sita that talks about shame.
Yep.
Then how do you actually draw the distinction between not feeling ashamed and
because earlier on it talks about how if you don't go any shame, then...
Sure. Yeah. The difference is that shame is like a natural emotional response. Okay. So you feel that response of shame when you think about it, right? Guilt is more like a desire to punish it. A desire you keep on going over it. You develop a narrative about it. It's not just a feeling. It's not just an emotional response, but it's a narrative where you say, "I'm guilty. I did this, and guilty means I have to be punished." So I have to make myself feel bad about it. So it's like you're taking that natural emotion of shame and you're turning it into something unnatural. You're making it much worse than it needs to be, rather than simply saying, "I made a mistake, I'll do better next time." Yeah? So it's more, the shame is like the natural emotion, the guilt is like the response you have to that emotion. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is the Rahula Vada Sutta. Now we also have a look at the Kakachupama Sutta, which is a wonderful sutta on many grounds. It has this lovely story of the maid Kali testing her mistress.
What's that called?
This is the Kakachupama Sutta, the simile of the saw. And I won't go into that story, even though it's a good story, but one thing I just will note in passing about this story, you know, you see this is quite strong, independent relationship that the maid has for the mistress, right? And even though that technically the word that's used for the maid here is dasi, right? Which literally you translate as slave or female slave. But you can see that the kind of what we're talking about here is slavery is very different from what we knew of in the West as being slavery. So much so that when Megasthenes, a Greek ambassador, was staying in Pataliputra, only 100 years or so after the Buddha, he said that there was no slavery in India. And this is not an isolated case, but there are actually many examples where, for example, there are cases in the Jatakas where the slave, the dasi, is going on a picnic with her friends, and the mistress says, "Oh, you have a nice picnic, and you know, here's my jewels and my gems. You know, you should make yourself look pretty, and you have some nice clothes, and you wear my gold and my diamonds for the picnic, right?" Not something you'd kind of expect in a Western context for the mistress to do to the slave, right? So it's obviously was quite a different kind of institution. And anyway, so poor old Mistress Vedehika got tested by Kali. In the same way, some monk here is very gentle, very meek, and very calm, so long as disagreeable ways of his speech do not assail him. Okay, so as long as things are going fine, then you can be happy, but when things go badly, then you get upset. And then the Buddha goes in, and this is a very lovely part of this teaching. There are five modes of speech which people might use when speaking to you. Speech that is timely or untimely. Right?
Return to the simile of the saw. What was the Buddha trying to teach through that simile? When I read it, I can't help but think along Western psychological lines. It seems to me the Kali as the servant is pushing the mistress, the employer. And it seems to me at one level it says, if you push anyone hard enough, they can get into no longer anger, but into rage. And the rage comes out as the wrongful act of hitting the other on the head. So that's the Western psychological interpretation that I give it. But what is the Buddha trying to teach in the simile of the soul?
Well, I think in that story, he's not trying to say that Kali was necessarily, you know, doing the right thing there.
No.
But I think he's more saying, I think he's kind of neutral in that, doesn't really make a point. But more the point is, I think that we can often present a face of kindness and so on, whereas there's cruelty manifesting underneath that. So this was that kind of point of that test, and to say for the monks that we're not just asking you to behave in a way that's kind when things are going nice to you, but even when you get tested like that, okay, and as if he's talking to senior monks, then you know that the junior monastics are going to test him in exactly the same way that Kali was testing the mistress there, right? So even when you're tested like that, then you should train yourself not to have that kind of response.
But the response is different. Now, one way of teaching me is that you can think about hitting someone on the head,
right,
because you're very angry at them,
right,
but you don't actually hit them on the head.
Right.
So the difference is in thought or in action.
Right.
Is the Buddha saying here that even in thought, we should not have the thought of hitting on the head?
Sure, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So there is a refinement there in non-violent thinking.
Very much so, and this one is setting a very high standard for non-violence. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, okay, so speech that is timely or untimely. So these things, this is a fantastic list of dhammas. You find these things all the way through the suttas. There's this kind of, there's this quality which is almost, you can't, it's so omnipresent through the suttas you don't notice it. And there's this kind of magisterial perfection about how the Buddha presented these things all the time, constantly, no matter what he was talking about or what context it was. And if you try actually doing that for a while, right? Try actually sitting in front of people and explaining right speech in a coherent manner, right? You realize how perfect so many of these things are. In this completely effortless way, he just puts it and you go, oh, that makes so much sense. Timely or untimely, true or false, gentle or harsh, with a good or harmful motive, with a loving heart or hostility, right? That's so true, isn't it? These are exactly the kinds of things that distinguish really good speech from crappy speech, yeah? Timely or untimely, yeah? It's so annoying. Isn't it annoying when people speak to you at the wrong time, right? You're really busy to trying to do something, and people come up to you, oh, Bande, can you do this, can you do that? You know, and this is something which if you're doing a profession, then you really have to manage that. So say someone like Enkong with his work, he has to make sure when he speaks to his clients or to his patients, it's done at the right time, right? They're going to bother him, you know, they're running to him at the shopping centre and say, oh, Enkong, I had this breakthrough about my mother. Then he'll say, come on, wait till the right time, you know. So, it's so dysfunctional. Right? To actually try to cope with these kinds of speech and be able to put it into a context, especially something that's important. Untimely or untimely, true or false. Yeah? We talk about gentle or harsh. Yeah? The manner that, it's not just a factual content, but the manner that you speak it in. With a good or harmful motive, right? Are you wishing the best for that person or wishing to help them? Yeah? Wishing to harm them. And this is not to get into, you know, sometimes in Buddhism we have this very passive-aggressive Buddhist approach to things, right? May you be happy. May you reap the fruits of your karma. Quickly. So these things have to be very, very genuine, yeah, with a loving heart or hostility. So no matter whether, but and so that's the speaker's job, is to ensure that they speak from that point of view, right? But also for the listener, good communication is not just the speaker, but also the listener. And from the listener's point of view, no matter whether they speak to you, in all of those cases, you should train yourself thus: I will not let my mind be affected, for I will not, for this matter, give vent to evil words. But we shall remain full of concern and pity with a mind of love, and we shall not give in to hatred. On the contrary, we shall live with thoughts of universal love for that person, making him, as well as the whole world, the object of our thoughts of universal love. Thoughts that have grown great, or a mind, literally not thoughts, but a mind that's grown great, exalted and measureless. We shall dwell radiating with this mind in a way that's void of hostility and ill will. In such a way, you should train yourself. And then this beautiful series of similes that the Buddha gives. Suppose, monks, a person were to come to you holding a hoe and a basket, and he were to say, I shall make this great earth to be without earth. And he would strew the earth here and there, spit here and there, and piss here and there, and he would say, be earthless, be earthless. What do you think? Could this person render this great earth to be without earth? Indeed not, most venerable sir. Why? Because this great earth, most venerable sir, is deep and without measure. It cannot possibly be made to be without earth. On the contrary, that person would only reap weariness and frustration. So in the same way, if someone speaks to you from all of those different matters, no matter how much hostility they have and no matter how bad their speech is, if your heart is so full of loving kindness, it's just not going to have any effect. It's a beautiful simile to understand how these things, now how the meditation, how the expansion of consciousness makes all these things so effortless. Yeah? It's not just a matter anymore of coping with it, right? But it's a matter of you've completely gone beyond that. Right? These things, there's nothing in your heart other than love for this person. And if they're speaking in a harsh or angry way, then you just have more compassion with them because they're obviously suffering. Yeah? And so the response in a deep level, so this is more talking to the deep level of ethics, right? It's not just keeping rules or refraining from speaking the wrong way or something like that, but it's you develop your consciousness in this magnificent way so that all of these things just get dissolved. Yeah? This is the beautiful part about this sutta is it leads from those very basic ordinary dhammas onto these beautiful statements about loving kindness. And finally, the end of the sutta, I'll have to wrap up in a minute. The end of the sutta talks about the parable of the saw itself. Even if bandits were to savagely sever you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, even then, whoever you harbors even a thought of ill will would not be upholding my teaching. This is how you should train yourself. Right? Okay, so that's something to live up to, yeah? So again, this idea of our ethical ideals is not just good enough, but something really profound and beautiful that we can aspire to.